This is the Future of IP Protection podcast, brought to you by MorphVision. This show is dedicated to arming companies with the skills, know-how, and technology they will need to future-proof their IP protection strategy for the years ahead.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for listening to another episode of the Future of IP Protection podcast. I'm Brandi Spence, Head of Marketing with MorphVision.
Last week, I had the privilege of sitting down with Mirta Hurtado Rivas, General Counsel for Brands, Marketing Properties, Licensing, and Anti-Counterfeiting at Nestle. Our conversation took a deep dive look into the landscape of IP protection, highlighting both the opportunities and the challenges presented by evolving technologies. We also explored the need for fluid IP strategies and the balance between safeguarding intellectual property, yet encouraging innovation. Mirta also shared her vision for the future of IP laws. From global to local trends to essential advice for better IP protection, this episode offers a rich and enlightening perspective. Whether you're an industry expert or you're just interested in the complexities of brand protection, I think you're going to find very valuable insights in my chat with Mirta Hurtado Rivas. So let's dive in. Mirta, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me, Brandi.
You have a really fairly impressive background. I was reading through it and you bring a wealth of experience and knowledge to the table. Before we dive into the world of IP protection, can you share a little bit more about yourself and how you arrived at your current role at Nestle?
Happy to do so. So I like to start with the fact that I am the daughter of immigrants. So my parents are Peruvian, emigrated to Europe in the late 60s. And our family then more or less kind of took roots in Europe, but we obviously still have very strong links to our home country, Peru. But most of my life I've spent in Switzerland. I was born and raised here, and I studied law in Switzerland. Now, funny enough, I didn't specialize in IP at all. I did do, you know, international public and private law. I wanted to go into diplomacy. I studied the Diplomatic Academy of Vienna, did a stint and the Peruvian consulate here in Zurich. So, you know, nothing at all was aiming me for a career in IP. But as things go, you know, paths can lead and take different turns, and finally you end up doing something else. How we ended up in my current position? Well, I started my career at the Swiss IP office. And during my tenure there, I did a master's degree. And there I was happy to meet someone from the pharma industry, a colleague of mine. And he just, you know, pointed to the fact that they were looking for someone for an in-house role at Novartis at the time, and the position was located in Germany. So 3 months after that, I was sitting in Germany and had taken on my first role as head of trademarks at Sandoz. And after that, I had another two different roles at Novartis, going back to headquarters and there and different responsibilities. And finally, after those 15 years there, Nestle approached me via LinkedIn. And I'm just saying this for our, you know, listeners, because it's really interesting to see how social media even now really englobe everything that we do, including actually recruitment. And yes, I've been with Nestle for a year and 8-9 months now and enjoying it very much so.
Oh, that's wonderful. What an interesting, you know, curve in your career, right? I think it's typical for people to take different, you know, paths. So it's really interesting to see that. Now, let's delve into some of the more pressing topics of the surrounding IP protection. I'm sure you have your own perspective on the current landscape of IP protection today. How would you summarize its state, and what are some of the challenges you think we face, particularly in maybe the context of brand protection and licensing?
So I would say that we have quite a mixed picture, because in some areas we have had big advancement in harmonization. We have a lot of international treaties and agreements and regulations actually provide a very solid framework for intellectual property. On the other hand, that's not the case for all countries. First of all, the IP systems are not at the same level of sophistication all around the globe. And some of the most important international treaties have not been yet, you know, joined by all countries. And hence, that makes it a bit more difficult. And still, we have also a lot of kind of very practical issues like legalization, authorization in an age where actually we are moving totally away from that type of thing. But at the same time, we still need to deal with that. We've kind of makes it more complex, and we have to always have like two systems, the digital one and then kind of the real mail, you know, wet signatures system. And that makes things a bit more complicated. Also, I would say with the digital age, you know, that has brought a lot of complexities for IP protection, which issues like online piracy, increasing counterfeiting, and infringement becoming also more prevalent nowadays. And the fact that this kind of trends become global make it also more difficult to enforce IP rights across borders effectively. And then when we look at emerging technologies like AI, so artificial intelligence, blockchain, 3D printing, those also present kind of unique challenges for IP protection. You know, just to name a few, we have the challenge around ownership, attribution, ability to monitor and enforce rights in a more and more interconnected world. So I think this is how I see things, a very practical side, but then also a very kind of forward-looking, more kind of digital.
Yeah, the AI thing has been just unreal to watch and the incredible pace that it's moving. And we know that laws sometimes tend to lag a little behind technology. How do you believe the IP protection laws should evolve to keep up with some of these developments?
That's a very good question, and one that I've been asked several times in the last couple of years. I think there is kind of, or at least at the time when we started talking about AI, there was kind of two camps. There were those that said our laws are totally insufficient. We need to, you know, scratch those and start from a skew, review everything. And then there were those that said, well, no, our current laws give us a framework that we can use, and we should rather work on interpreting those in a way that makes sense according to the current circumstances. And I think to me, the solution is always kind of in the middle. I think we need to make an effort to look at how we interpret laws that already exist, and to make sure that we use those as much as we can. And I think we have good experience, you know, because we all went through the big boom of internet in the year 2000. And at that time, we had the same questions, right? How are we going to deal with this? We don't have the laws. And at the end of the days, in most countries, we could rely on the basic trademark, patent, and design and copyright laws to actually deal with the internet and the consequences of it. I think something similar is that, you know, we need to adapt for today. But obviously, at the same time, I think we need to start reviewing laws. We need to start seeing where is it that effectively we're missing something that doesn't allow us to actually protect innovation via AI or via other technologies that are kind of disrupting our trade today. So, and maybe just a minor point, I think that there has been also discussions around lex specialis. Do we have, you know, a need for any additional special laws to those existing? And I think also there has been also very heated discussions, and some people have said, no, the more, you know, special laws we have is going to be more and more complex. I think we forgot that, for instance, we had regulatory data protection, which is really a specific law in the pharma sector that was adapted very well, was implemented without any difficulties. And today, nobody thinks about it as something extraordinary. So I think we have to keep an open mind and think about those examples when we think about how to, you know, change things for the framework of intellectual property overall.
That is a very good point. Okay, so now we've been talking about AI and some of those technologies as being a threat, or how we protect against those. Can you think about how we can leverage it to our benefit as well and in IP protection?
So I think if you let me start by the more basic aspect of it, I think that AI and AI-based tools mostly are those that are going to help us actually to do more with less. So, you know, when it comes to docketing, when it comes to management of entry of emails, when it comes to interacting with outside counsel, interacting internally, chatbots answering basic questions, all of that is actually not anymore 10, 15 years away, but we are seeing already some of it being implemented today. So that's just like, you know, how to manage portfolios, how to manage that is
right,
being leveraged and rendered more effective and efficient because of AI. Then we have also the tools that are helping us, you know, and I always kind of keep track, and I'm looking for everything which is in the area of monitoring. So AI can help a lot with that. And it's been actually helpful already in other areas where you need to combine visuals, sound, And, you know, so for instance, in the insurance area, for many, many years already, AI is being used to, for instance, when there is an incident in an insurance case, they already utilize AI to put everything together and then to have, like, as a result, how much you will be granted, as you know, as a sum to compensate for the damage. This is years ago. And I think that nothing precludes from us going into the same direction. We have visuals, we have written word, we have sounds, and we have images, right? So, and we are starting to see some of that coming. So for searching, for monitoring, even for trademark creation or brand creation, for all of that, actually, AI will be really, really interesting to watch and see what's coming. But I think we're closer than we think to some disruptive technologies to come and to be adapted and actually allow us to be faster, right? So when I hear, I'm seeing some of the tools we need today a week for searches when there are more than 4 or 5 countries. With AI-based tools, we may do that in half an hour, 45 minutes.
That'd be nice, right?
So that's super interesting. But obviously, we need to also learn how to manage risk there. When it comes to blockchain, you know, it goes without saying that, you know, we have started to use blockchain when it comes to how can we secure some stuff that we don't necessarily don't want to protect via IP rights. And also, how do we want to make something kind of permanently accessible and readable by many different parties? So I think all of those things come together. And to me, they're really something that will enhance the way we work. It will also create new opportunities for us to think as to how we can, what else can we do for our businesses? What else can we do for our clients to actually make their life easier and even create additional opportunities of protection that we are not thinking of right now or for which we don't have enough means at the moment?
Right. Interesting. Okay. Switching topics a little bit. Brand and marketing properties play a significant role in a company's success, and having a strong IP strategy is crucial for their protection. Drawing from your experience, can you share your insights on the importance of an effective IP strategy in this context, and what are the key elements that you believe would contribute to that success?
That's actually a good question, and I like to kind of step back a little in the sense that I think sometimes we look at IP strategy as something that we need to take off and
right.
say, I've put together a document, this is my IP strategy, done and dusted. I think it's a little bit more complex than that. And it took me also a while to understand that when I was a young lawyer, because actually an IP strategy is never a document that is set in stone, because actually the IP strategy necessarily needs to follow the business strategy. And our days, actually, the business strategy can change very quickly. First of all, because we see that there is a lot of, you know, mergers and acquisitions. So every time that happens, you need to revise as to how those businesses kind of, you know, are integrated into your company if the current IP strategy is applicable to that new business. But also just more in a larger sense, with all the technical developments that we see and that have an impact on trade, the IP strategy needs to be kind of reviewed every time something new hits us. For instance, ChatGPT. Right? We didn't think about it last December. Well, now, hello, look at all marketeers going all frantic and crazy about ChatGPT. And then we need to say, well, we hadn't thought about kind of marketing materials being reviewed by ChatGPT or even created or slogans being created or even trademarks. You can ask ChatGPT, whatever, right? So I think what I'm trying to say is that, first of all, it's really important to never think about it as a document that is set in stone. And the other thing is that beyond understanding what IP may have as an impact, we need to really understand what directions our businesses are taking and then try to actually proactively foresee what else we could do. Because as long as we only cover what exists and maybe what is in the launch plan, I think it's not yet a strategy. That's just covering, you know, the basics and doing what we need to protect things. But IP is much more than that. And so we need to really become business partners. We need to also learn a lot about what business is and means. And then based on that, we need to adapt kind of key elements of what, you know, that contribute to our IP strategy. And that can start by IP portfolio management, innovation support, commercialization efforts, enforcement and protection measures, risk management, policies and procedures, education and awareness, collaboration, monitoring, and obviously integration into the business strategy. So I think it's very vast. And that's why I always recommend to start by really understanding the business first and from there build and look as to how that evolves and how also the business reacts to our strategy, because sometimes we have a tendency to do that for ourselves because we want to have the framework, but actually it's really a give and take with the business.
Interesting. I've been talking to several different companies as part of the podcast, obviously, and some of them have been in the Shark Tank world too recently, which have been these smaller companies. And it's one of those things that's very interesting, as you mentioned. Where is the business today? Where are you planning on going? And seeing where they are in their different strategies. And these different companies are, you know, in different stages. It's so critical and important. And we have that conversation afterwards, like, okay, this is good. This is where you're at. But consider this, like, you're going here and these things are going to happen. And yeah, it's important that you're always on top of it because it's not stagnant at all.
I think just an example, right? When we started thinking about digital around 2014, 15, I think mostly people saw digital is going to be for services, right? Why should we care about we are selling a specific product and that product is still going to be bought by the consumer? You know, they're going to touch it and they're going to consume it in some way. Our days, we all understand that actually, yes, we still are in some industries in the kind of area of products, consumer goods. But we also know that we need a ton of services to cover all the platforms, all the social media, all the awareness raising, information sharing, and so on. And if you don't foresee that, then you might just kind of missing on huge opportunities. And I think, you know, some of us just started doing that afterwards when we realized, okay, we're missing a trend here. Right. And so I said it's really important to even think wider. And I always like to look at what's happening in other areas that might be, you know, similarly regulated than IP. And sometimes that can be an inspiration.
Now, you have a wealth of experience in trademark and design, copyright, and domain name law. With globalization and digitalization, what emerging trends are you seeing in brand protection beyond those that perhaps what we've spoken about? How are organizations likely adapting to these trends?
That's a good question. I think there is two things that I would like to highlight. The first one being that we talk a lot about globalization in the digital age. And I think we don't need to forget that with COVID and with the economic crisis that we're facing today, there is also the movement that is contrary to that, where we have a strong actually focus on local, where people are going back to kind of looking at why don't we produce certain things back home? Why do we need to rely on a supply that comes from so far away?
Right.
Even for environmental issues, right? People are asking themselves, would it not be wiser to buy this product just from the neighboring farm? Or do we need to ship this, right? So there is also the contrary, you know, kind of we're looking at both things at the same time. And I think it's really important to not forget that. Because yes, we need to find ways as to how to better enforce across, you know, frontiers, boundaries, and so on. We need to find better ways as to how to digitally monitor and do those things. But at the same time, we need to also very strongly make sure that we don't miss on what's happening at the local and regional level and what that means for our products, services, companies overall, and how we need to go back to understanding what that means, right? So in many countries, we are seeing a lot of laws being deployed with respect to restrictions of brands. Those are very local. If you look at brands restrictions only as a kind of global trend that is happening, you'll miss on the different drivers at the local level. And even though they may have a similar impact on your products, it's not the same root cause. And you will need to spend time on that. So actually, I think that we are really in this matrix thinking where we need to stay very up to date globally, follow all the trends, you know, not lose that. At the same time, we need to have a network of either internal, you know, resources or external resources to make sure that we don't miss on any of those, I would say, more local trends that are happening at the same time. I think one of the things that to me has become more and more important is really proactive brand management and reputation protection in the digital age. Because I think in the old times, sometimes, you know, some big house marks weren't that well known. And it was the products that were kind of the very well-known brands of some companies. And I think that has changed radically with social media. Because nowadays, one little incident is sufficient to really tarnish the entire reputation of a company, even though it might be just for that one famous product. But immediately people start talking not only about that, but then it just like goes all over.
It spreads like wildfire. Yes.
Exactly. And so I think that is really something that is important to bear in mind and to also explain internally, right? Because some people say, well, counterfeiting, oh, we don't have an issue in counterfeiting, for instance, not yet in our country. So why should we prepare for that? And I said, well, the issue is that even one incident could be sufficient to not only have, let's say, an impact on consumer safety or loss of revenue, but the reputational aspect is huge. And we need to be prepared for that. And so there is no way that we can, you know, say, well, until it happens, we do nothing or we don't prepare for it. So I think that's really important. And as we were mentioning before, you were asking about, you know, technological developments. Well, those developments don't happen only for AI, right? They happen for everything. And hence, we need to kind of think about, you know, what are the legal implications, potential risk associated with those technologies.
Amazing. So switching gears for a moment here completely. Okay. Something we talked about a little bit before we actually started recording, but you have a fluency in multiple languages, which is a very remarkable asset, especially in dealing with global business. And I'll just say, I'll brag for you here. You speak 5 different languages. How has that skill really helped you in your work as an IP professional? And what advice would you give to others who are looking to develop similar skills like this? Not probably working on Babel or whatnot, but...
Yeah, so obviously it goes without saying that being able to speak to people in their local language makes a big difference, because sometimes it just breaks down those barriers that people have when you are on calls or you know, as soon as they see like, oh, she understands my native language, that obviously will just kind of, you know, create a stronger bond, even if you like or don't like the person, but it just gives a certain level of comfort. And based on the languages I know fluently, I've always tried to learn others to make sure that whenever I go to a country, I can at least have basic discussions, you know, order my food, say hello, introduce myself. That puts people so much at ease. And I also think it's because it translates into understanding that you are making an effort and that you respect the culture. So for me, the knowledge about the language in isolation is probably not as effective as when you combine that with an understanding of the culture related to the language. It's when you combine both that it becomes really a powerful tool. I think that when you just speak the language, that's, you know, it's nice. But actually what will bond with others is the fact when you have an insight, right? I travel somewhere and I know exactly, oh, in this country, they don't have the same holidays as we have. It's because when I learned the language, I went through those festivities and everything around that. So I have that knowledge and people appreciate that I'm aware of that. And as an advice, I would say, you know, some of us were lucky. We were brought up with several languages already during our childhood. If you're not, or if you couldn't do so at that age, I think I would always say, pick your languages, you know, carefully. You need to feel like a personal inclination and passion for a specific language. Otherwise, it's very, very difficult to do it just for business reasons. And the other thing is, I say, especially for the parents out there, just remember, not every child can become a polyglot, even if you teach them 5 languages when they're 2 years old. Some of us are just more inclined for languages and some others aren't. And I think it's really important to respect the fact that all of us have different strengths and they will do other great stuff. So yes, having languages is a great tool, but let's not forget that that's not always for everyone, right?
That's great advice. Did you learn yours all when you were young or did you learn them as you were older?
So I was brought up in German and Spanish. So that was very helpful because this was one Latin language and obviously German being very, very different. So that kind of hones your skills to navigate between 2 very different languages. Then I was lucky that the environment I was in my kind of teenage age was French speaking. So I picked up French. And later on, obviously, English was added to school. And I decided then to spend a year in Rome while I was studying. So the languages really were in that very naturally to me. It's more the other languages that I'm trying to learn. You know, I did Russian for 7 years. I learned Portuguese for a number of years, Danish. and now I'm learning Serbian, and I continue to really try to learn other languages. I think that's kind of a passion, right? It's not so much to do with the business, but it's a passion.
Yeah, and I'm sure it helps to have a good base of multiple languages to be able to pick those up, right? So
definitely.
Without a doubt. All right. Well, balancing the need for IP protection and innovation with creativity, it can be a delicate dance. So how do you approach this challenge? And how do you strike a balance between protecting IP rights and allowing for innovation to thrive?
That's a very good question. And when I was in my previous role in a totally different industry in pharma, I spent a lot of times with my patent colleagues, right? And we were sitting on the same leadership team. We had a lot of scientific discussions. And I still remember when we started having open source kind of innovation coming up in our field, right? In the pharma field, it was very, very interesting to see how strong at that time, many years ago, right? The feeling was there that we had to own everything, right? The feeling was, you know, if you are in the IP field, you need to protect everything, but then you have to own it. If you don't own it, then, you know, we shouldn't enter into those types of collaboration. We shouldn't be looking even at products or services that we cannot protect in some way. And I think we've come a long way. I think things have changed a lot, be it in pharma, but also be it in other areas like the current one where I am. And I think for me, it's really about balancing IP protection and fostering innovation. It's really about protecting what makes sense. In a world like ours, where things change so rapidly, I often even question if we need trademarks for certain things. Because I'm like, okay, how long is this service going to be around? How long is the product going to be around? Is this more of a seasonal product? Are we going to change flavor, shape, whatever? So I think it really is about asking the right questions when you interact with your marketing colleagues about what is really the intent of something and what is really the upside of owning a right? Because owning a right comes with a lot of also investment of resources, be it human or financial. So I think it's a question of exploring that. And I think it's not always the best option to own IP rights when you look at that from that perspective. I think collaboration and partnerships in open source context are increasingly important, especially because you need those small startups to come with fresh eyes and with very fresh ideas to actually, you know, populate those incredible innovations that sometimes in a very kind of, I would say, more structured framework is difficult to achieve. So, you know, I think it's really about striking a balance and exploring collaborations and open innovation. We can actually encourage, you know, creativity without stifling it.
I would assume, and correct me if I'm wrong, that in your role, you collaborate quite a bit with the other business units within the industry. Right. So you're doing engineering or whatever. Yes. Marketing, all that good stuff. Yeah. So key. All right. Well, let's look ahead. We're curious about your vision for the future of IP protection. How do you envision the landscape 5 years from now? And in what ways do you see perhaps your role evolving in the years to come?
Yeah, that's also a good question, right? And I wish I would have like the magic ball to look into that because as you correctly mentioned it, right? Like for instance, ChatGPT has been a total disruptor. And I don't think that any of us really had foreseen this being embraced so quickly by so many of us. So for me, really, it's pretty much around technology. This is going to be and will continue to be the one thing that we really need to watch, that we really need to figure out how to embrace. Right. Because it's really not only about looking at what are the services out there or what are the tools out there, but it's really also about making sure that we change mindsets. It's easier said than done. And when we look at the population that is actually delivering most of the legal services, we don't have many people yet that come really from that period of time that have been born and raised with all these technological tools. And so there is a gap, right? There's a gap. Many of us, and I say this because sometimes we were speaking about laws before. Sometimes when I hear people saying like, oh, this is how things should go and whatever, most of the people talking about this are above 40 and have been doing this job for 15 years or 10 at least. Those are not the people that are utilizing most of the technological tools that we have at hand. They are not those, you know, being in the metaverse. They are not those utilizing ChatGPT to write their, you know, documents or whatever, or this. And I think there is a big gap between users of new technologies and us trying to frame them adequately. So I think that's something that we need to look into. I personally think that the evolution of the digital landscape also comes with a lot of opportunities. Opportunities to, you know, accelerate things, to do things differently, to deliver more things to the business than we ever thought was possible in a much shorter timeline. I also think that one thing that will become increasingly important, it's already important, that it's been always important for IP, but collaboration, you know, across borders with authorities, between companies, so private sector, public sector, all of that needs to be even, you know, leveraged even more. And I think in particular, the fields like consumer protection, counterfeiting, and so on, if we don't do that as a trade association, together with other companies, together with government or even NGOs, there is very little we can achieve. So I think that that's really important. So collaboration to make sure that we can actually face the complexities in IP enforcement. And you raised, I think, the second part of your question was really about my role. And I think, you know, I've always loved change. I'm someone who probably was raised like that, like, you know, because we moved and because we lived in different countries. So for me, change has always had a positive connotation. And I count on, you know, trying to continue to evolve and to these changes that we just mentioned. For me, really adapting emerging technologies is key. But as I mentioned, we have to always change the mindset of those not utilizing those tools today. And it's not an easy thing to do. As you remember, a long time ago when we were monitoring trademarks, we used to receive paper notifications. And getting rid of those paper notifications was not an easy thing when I, you know, recommended to my team, okay, let's switch. It took a project that took a couple of months for something that today nobody would believe that we ever wanted to have a piece of paper in our hands to decide if a trademark is similar or not. So for me, it's really crucial to kind of foster a mindset of curiosity. We need to figure out how can we motivate people to be curious about this new stuff. And this obviously also entails that we need to create an environment that gives room for try and fail. So if we don't create an environment where it's okay to try out something and then to fail totally and loss of time and sometimes money, then I think it's going to be very, very difficult to actually really get what we can out of those new technologies. We need to have a different type of mindset. And that would obviously then have a huge impact on our IP protection strategies based on those tools. So I also anticipate that I will be looking more proactively at strategies for anticipating the needs of the business. So it's a little bit like playing, you know, it's sometimes you feel like a little bit like playing poker. Your gut feeling tells you something is coming, there is a trend.
Yeah.
But you don't know for sure. And I think that goes again into the area of we need to embrace risk differently than we have done so far. And that's, I think, about, you know, cybersecurity and those things. We need to figure out something there, but no one has a real answer. So we'll need to just, you know, believe in something, go for it. And then as we move forward, just adapt. So I think adaptability for me is going to be key for my role, for my function. That's really, really, really very important.
Yeah, really interesting. Adaptability, curiosity, change, without a doubt, because it's coming whether we want it or not. All right. Well, as we wrap up, we'd love to hear you give us three pieces of actionable advice for IP professionals who might be listening in. What would be your top recommendations to succeed at IP protection for the future? It sounds like you've sort of hit on these. Is there anything else that you would add to it?
Well, I said the first advice is don't think about IP protection only with respect to legal services. That's one part. But in order to be able to deliver the best legal service, we need to make sure that we utilize our resources in an efficient manner. So we need to think about what is the best option. Do we need to offshore, outsource? Do we need more technological tools to cope? Going back to what I said before, we need to constantly think about how can we do more with less, because budgets are going to stay flat and work is going to increase. So with that in mind, it's not only about, do we have the best lawyers? Do we have the best advice? Is the quality of outside counsel the best? Right? To also have the most efficient processes internally and externally. And only with that, based on that, we will be able to build the other layers. If we don't have those processes and also processes to review processes, so recurring way of thinking, challenging ourselves, am I doing things in the most simple manner? Am I communicating in the fastest, most intelligible way? If those questions are not raised, you will not be able to find the resources to do the rest because we will be just, you know, stuck in the past. So I think for me, that's really fundamental. So I shout out to all the lead of IP services, so paralegals out there. You're crucial to the success of IP protection. The second one is, you know, it's been kind of the red thread through our entire discussion. It's been technological developments. We need to stay on top of those. And I think we shouldn't shy away to invest time. And again, right, so we're already very busy. All of us have enough to do. But you need to figure out someone in your team or part of yourself to really spend time going out there and exploring new options, new possibilities. And yes, in my previous role and this role, we have been always piloting things. We love to pilot things. Sometimes they work perfectly nice and it's a great advantage. And sometimes they are terrible. But if you don't do it, you'll never know. So I tell people we should try and fail to really know what's the value that these tools can give us. And again, you know, it's embracing change, making sure we adapt our mindset. And the third, I think particularly for me, because you only give me a chance to say about the three tips. but
you got a couple more?
The third one is really about building and retaining the right talent. I think it goes back to what we were saying. In order to understand how commerce is being done our day, in order to understand how the next generation will buy products, we need to have them on board. And we cannot any longer look only at educational credentials or, you know, work experience. We need to look as to who is just like, you know, IT knowledgeable. You know, do we have lawyers out there that are also passionate about games in the virtual world? Do we have people out there that know how to do work on software because they were passionate about that when they were in college or something? You know, is there people who are curious? I think one of the major things I'm looking for when I recruit today is like, I try to figure out if people like challenges and are curious. Will they, you know, if something new comes up, will they be more scared of that? Or will they kind of go and say, oh, this is a new toy for me to do my job, right? So I think for me, you know, picking the right talent is really important. And I think it's really about being diverse, but in the true sense, not only diversity of backgrounds, religion, ethnicity, and so on, but really also diverse as to how you think, ways of thinking. And that's not the easy one. It's one that brings a lot of discomfort sometimes, right? And you said to me, well, I have the chance to raise a fourth point. And I think it's one that comes up a lot, is we need to do a better job as to explain what the role of IP is in overall commerce, be it with respect to authorities, you know, what our impact is on trade overall, growth, you know, economic growth in countries, but also internally. You know, how can we make sure that everyone within a company or within our organization understands what IP can do and how we can add value across the entire, actually, you know, I would say life cycle of our products or services?
Well, those are really great pieces of advice. And we actually even got a fourth. So that's where I come from in New Orleans. We call that a lanyap. So thank you, Mirta. And Mirta, thank you so much for sharing your expertise and your valuable insights with us today. It's just been a pleasure having you on our show and having you as a guest. If any of our listeners would like to get in touch with you, where would be a good place for them to find you?
Yeah, my preferred way of communication is really LinkedIn, because there, you know, you can look at what people want from you and easily connect. And just with respect to that, because I also share on LinkedIn a lot about LeaderChain, which is actually, I'm the founder of LeaderChain. We produce a podcast, but it's also an association that looks into leadership and coaching and has a focus on diversity and inclusion. So if people are interested about that, then also feel free to get in touch with me.
No, I'm very interested myself in that. Well, thank you so much for your time. And to our listeners, thank you for listening. We hope to have you back on an upcoming episode of the Future of IP Protection podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Future of IP Protection podcast brought to you by Mark Vision. If you enjoyed today's show, please do us a favor and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. And if you'd like to learn more about how Mark Vision can help you transform your IP protection strategy, visit us at markvision.com. Thanks again, and I'll catch you on the next episode.